yesterday. I told a story yesterday with some of the folks in the 9:30 hour that maybe has some theological significance. Maybe it has some more. Maybe you can decide. It has little to do with what we're going to do later today, but still a great story. A friend of mine had a sailboat up in Fishing Bay, which is near Gwynn's Island, near Deltaville, if you know that area. And he had a little sunfish along with that, which I'm told is maybe 12, 13 foot long, not much of a space to sit in. But had a friend named Harvey where he was working at the time, and Harvey had never been out in a sailboat, mainly because Harvey didn't swim, and Harvey was terrified of being drowned. But my friend convinced him to come along on the sailfish, and at that particular area, they were, I don't know, half a mile off of the shoreline, maybe a quarter of a mile, but quite a ways out. And the wind caught the sailfish, flipped it over, threw Harvey out into the water, threw my friend out into the water. Harvey's flailing away at the water. Oh, God, I'm going to die. Oh, God, I'm going to die. Somebody save me. Somebody save me. My friend was there. He's about 5'7", and he put his feet down, and his feet were on the bottom of the water. So he reaches over, grabs the sunfish to keep him going away, and watches Harvey for a minute. Oh, God, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Somebody save me. And after a while, he took pity, and he shouted, Harvey! Oh, God, I'm going to die. Harvey pays no attention. Shouted a second time, Harvey! No response. Oh, God, oh, God, something, something. Harvey! Harvey finally stops. What? My friend says, stand up. Harvey stands up, the water's too bad. That's a true story. And I don't know what to do with it and where to use it. I've used it a couple of places already.
My thought is we all do panic.
Oh, yeah.
How many times scripture said, stand firm, stand, and we don't even do it.
Harvey, what?
Stand up.
Stand up. I told that story, and somebody who has a river house out in that area. So that's Fishing Bay. Fishing Bay is the one that stays shallow way, way out. And I said, yeah, that's right. That's where my hint is. But nothing to do with what we're going to do. 2 Samuel chapter 7. If you can find 2 Samuel chapter 7. I'm asking you to find this so that you know where we were last week. Those of you who may not have been with us, some, the very top line up there is a website where you can find the lessons online, assuming this little recorder works, and you'll find those for each week. This was where we were last week. And the thing I want you to pay attention to was, first verse, David has settled into his palace. He's conquered Jerusalem. He's built himself a palace in Jerusalem. It says God had given him rest from all the enemies surrounding him. And when God gave him rest from all the enemies surrounding him, that meant his mind had a chance to go in some other places. And what I want to do is link what we did last week with what we're going to do this week. Where does his mind take him? The first place it takes him to is, there's something not right. I'm living in a palace, and the Ark of the Covenant, the sign of the presence of God, that's under a tent. That's not right. And the whole of chapter 7 talks about the consequences of that. If you remember, if you were here last week, this actually brings us into the fourth of five big covenants that God makes with people in the pages of the Old Testament. And we spent some time last week talking about that fourth covenant. So I want you to just be aware that that was the setting for that. Second thing I want you to be aware of, that 2 Samuel 7 is paralleled in 1 Chronicles. 1 and 2 Chronicles overlay 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. It's not six books that sort of progress a certain distance. It's four books that do that, and then two books that come back and sort of wander over that same territory. So if you look at 1 Chronicles 17, you find almost the same record, a little bit of adjustment here and there as the writer of Chronicles seems to be saying, well, maybe I need to clarify here, or maybe I need to add another sentence there. Okay, so that's where we ended last week. We talked about chapter 7 and all the implications from the fourth covenant. Today, we're coming down off a mountain. That was a high spot for the whole of the Old Testament, certainly a high spot for this part of the Old Testament. And it sort of seemed to come out of nowhere, and when it's over, we're sort of back down. The level of theological insight, the level of significance of what we're going to read is lower than it was in this one chapter, and I want to acknowledge that. So let's go into chapter 8, if you will. If you go into chapter 8, what you find is all the fighting starts back up, or else the writer has put chapter 7 in a place that's not necessarily chronological, because David's fighting again and his armies are fighting again. Who does it start with? Who does he defeat?
Philistines.
That's verse 1. Verse 2, who does he defeat? Moabites. Who do we know that was from Moab?
Ruth
was from Moab. Remember when she went over and came, we talked about that a while back. So there was problems over there. When you come to verse 3, where's the place? What's the name of the place? You have to get by the name of the king. You have to get by the name of his daddy. What's the name of the place? We're going to agree on Zobah. Is that okay?
Yeah.
That may not be right, but that's what we're going to use today. Zobah. And if you notice, David attacking that particular place was because they had sort of attacked first. Exactly where that is not perfectly clear. My translation has the last word of verse 3 as trying to extend their power over the river, capitalized. I think that probably is the Euphrates, so this is maybe as far up as modern-day Iraq. It may show you the extent of David's kingdom. It talks about all the people that they captured and what they did with them and all the equipment they captured. What does it say in verse 5? People from Aram, Arameans, came to the aid of this particular king, and what happened to them? They had trouble too. Okay, and so if you look at verse 6, Aram, which had seems to be part of modern day Syria, mentions Damascus, they became David's subjects. Each was paying tribute, and it says at the end of verse 6, wherever David went, the Lord gave him victory. Do you see that phrase? Okay, would you come to the end, not quite the end of chapter 8, to the tail end of verse 14, you should see that same phrase repeated a second time. Do you see it? Wherever David went, the Lord gave him victory. Okay? So who's he got victory over so far? The Philistines have been fought back. Moab has been fought back. Zobah has been suppressed or put into a vassal situation, and the people from Aram who tried to come to his aid did so as well. What did David collect from these people? Look at verse 7 and look at verse 8. He collected gold, and he collected, tail end of verse 8,
bronze.
What did he do with it? Answer is, we don't know, because it doesn't say here, but it says later, so keep an eye on that, right? Verse 9, what's the country, or what's the people group? Hamath, Hamath, let's say Hamath for today, is that okay? Guy's name in my translation is Tau or Tou, T-O-U, is that right? You have that? Toy? Or two, if it was Y-O-U, it'd be U. What does yours have? Yours has T-O-I. Okay, mine has T-O-U. He's the king of what place? Hamath, right? And what is he? What is he reported as doing? He heard something first. What did he hear? David's been fighting this guy that we mentioned from Zobah back up in verse 3, whose name we're going to not try to pronounce, but it starts with H and has lots of letters. Okay. And what is this king of Hamath saying to David? He's saying thank you. And how does he say thank you? First he sends his son. Right? And his son carries with him gold and silver and bronze. He sent his son, Hadoram, to King David to greet him and to congratulate him on having made war and on having defeated him. I think it would have been enough if he had just fought him. It would have taken his attention away from Hamath. Hadoram also brought with him objects made of silver, gold, and bronze. What did David do with those objects? Now it tells you. Yours says dedicated. Mine says consecrated to the Lord. And then it's got a comma and it says something. What does it say? Just as he had been doing with all these other things. So the things back up in verse 7, one presumes they would have been the same thing. Now, Pause for a moment and let's take a look way down the line. We're not going to be there anytime soon, but look way down the line. The time is going to come where Solomon is going to try to build the temple. The resources to build the temple, both the things to adorn it and the resources to pay for it, are coming from this kind of stuff. Much, much later in the history of Israel, some representatives from Babylon come to a king way later in the line, and the king opens up the treasury and shows them all of these things, and God says through a prophet, you did the wrong thing. What you've done is you've generated greed among the Babylonians, and they're going to come back and take you away. So these objects and the gold and the silver and all that become a big deal all the way through. One of the things it will say about Solomon much later is that he's going to take bronze, maybe this bronze, I don't know. But he's going to take bronze and make an object that he calls the sea, S-E-A. It appears to have been a big, huge, circular or oval, we don't know for sure. I think it's circular. Shaped maybe like a wok, nobody knows for sure, but it was able to hold water. And when you come to Revelation, there's actually reference to this object and to some of the function that it had in the worship setting of things. Okay, so all this is beginning now with the accumulation of this wealth. A lot of us think it comes under Solomon, but it's actually started under David, the bringing in of resources for a while. Okay? And it says at the tail end of verse 11, he's already been doing this with all the things, the silver and the gold he took from all the nations he had subjugated. And then in verse 12, it gives you a brief list of those. And some of those in the list weren't in the rest of the chapter. So let's go through that list. I see Aram there. I see Moab. What else do I see? Ammon, which would be where the Ammonites are from. The Philistines were mentioned, but Amalek wasn't. If you think back to where we've been over the last year or so, as we've come out of the first five books of the New Testament, Old Testament, Amalek was one of the countries that seems constantly to be pounding against Israel, and now they're defeating those. Okay, and then verse 13, mine says he became famous as if he wasn't before when he came home from defeating the Edomites, the people of Edom. Where did Edom arise? What's their heritage? That's Isaac and Esau way, way, way back. Isaac and Esau, way, way, way back. Esau's family populated Edom, and Isaac's family eventually are the ones who are populating this. So that's an old rivalry that's back there. So far, okay? Now, I don't know if yours says famous where mine says famous, but that's the term that I see there. Okay? Seemed like there was something else I was going to say, but I can't think what it was. Yes, I do know what I want to say. I want you to pause for just a minute and jump over to chapter 10. I want you to pause for just a minute and jump over to chapter 10. Okay? If you look at verse 6, we're going to come back to this before we're finished today. We'll be this far, but I want to give you a little preview here. The people of Ammon were in the list, right? But it looks like they're not completely in the list because in chapter 10, here they are at war with them again. But if you start reading through, it sounds a whole lot like what you just read in chapter 8. And so what I want to tell you is, you look at the commentators, they're not sure if you're seeing the same series of events from two different viewpoints, one in chapter 8, one in chapter 10, or if you're seeing two different times. They were subjugated for a while, then they came back up and had to go be knocked down again. If you've ever played whack-a-mole, maybe something like that's what he's dealing with. But if you take a look at some of the same players, if you take a look at the end of verse 6, it says people from Aram who happened to be living in Zobah. You see that coming out again? And if you come down a little further, by the time you get down to verse 16, the people of Aram have been involved in this, along with the people of Ammon, and they've realized they've got problems, and here comes that same old guy from chapter 8 that's mentioned again. So I simply say that there seems to be some uncertainty as to whether these are two different times, but the same players are involved. I'll leave that for you to worry about separately. Let's come back to chapter 8. The last little bit of chapter 8, remember verse 14 ended with a repeat of that phrase, wherever David went, the Lord gave him victory. Now, starting at verse 15, it begins to tell you, just for a moment, it tells you who the leaders were of Israel. It starts, of course, with David. That's what verse 15 says. He ruled over all Israel, administering, my says, law and justice to all his people. And then verse 16 begins with who?
Joab.
And what's his function?
He's
the commander, mine says, of the army. It then names a second person. Who's the second person? What's his name? Jehoshaphat. My grandfather had a mule named Jehoshaphat. We could ride three at a time on that mule. I thought that's the greatest name I've seen in the Bible, for mules anyway. There's later going to be a king with that same name, but here's a guy named Jehoshaphat. What was his job? Yours says recorder. Mine says herald. Both of those are lousy interpretations, I think. Yours says secretary, and that's not even as good as that. I'm sorry. Are you sure you're looking at the right place? Because the word secretary comes in my translation a verse later. I'm staying up with Jehoshaphat.
Yeah.
Yours says scribe later. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does anybody have a different translation? Because we had two translations in the first hour that were really good.
Recorder.
Yeah, yours says recorder. That's what mine says, herald. Nobody's got it? Okay, first hour, one of the translations was royal historian, and the other was archivist. Okay? Now, does this bring a little bit different meaning to it? Somebody who records the minutes of a meeting is not necessarily writing a history of what happened. They're writing the primary accounts from which a historian might really work. So in my translation, if you jump down to verse 17, at the end of verse 17, it says a guy named Sariah or something like that was the secretary, you said scribe at that point. I think that's the person who was taking minutes at the meeting. A comment for what it's worth, if you ever find some place where meetings are going on and nobody's taking minutes, I would encourage you to be worried. And I don't really mean for you to laugh. I mean that seriously. If you find a place where they're not recording minutes for meetings, you got a problem. You got a problem. Because you don't have the primary records. What was done, what was said, what was decided. You don't have a record of that. But in my reading of this, the historian and the archivist, the one who keeps track of all the immediate documents to put it together, and the person who is responsible for trying to make some sense of that over time. These things will continue all the way through this period, and by the time you get to the end of this, by the time you get over into Kings, you'll find places where it says this particular king died is not all of what he did recorded in the annals of the kings of Israel. That's probably where this is starting, and that's what I'm trying to get you to bring your attention to. Okay? Now, that finishes verse 16. Verse 17, there's two people. In my translation, it's Zadok and Abiathar, who is the son of Ahimelech. At least one translation in the first hour reversed that. They said Ahimelech was the son and the other one was the father. So I don't know which way to iron that one out. I didn't realize that was a discrepancy. But what was their function?
Priests.
They were priests. We all agree on that? Okay. And then we have the guy who was the secretary. And then we have in verse 18, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada. And what was his function? He was in charge of?
Something
and something. Now, this is the point in the first hour where I ask if anybody had a study Bible. And if you don't have a study Bible, Christmas is only 6.5 months away. You got a chance to get one by Christmas. If you got a study Bible, it's going to give you references out in the margin, other scripture verses to look up to try to cross-reference with this. And it sometimes will give you footnotes. So my question is, do you have a study Bible? And does yours have a footnote at this point that might help you understand who this is?
Mine just has a scripture, 1 Samuel 30:14.
And did you look up 1 Samuel 30:14?
I'm getting ready to.
You're getting ready to. Well, if you learn anything, let me know. Let me tell you what mine says, and this will stun you. These two groups, he says, are mercenaries from Philistia, that's Philistines, who were David's bodyguards. He conquers the Philistines, and he turns some of them into his bodyguards. Well, go back and remember for a minute. There was a king from Philistia, from Gath, that David and his people were bodyguards, right? So maybe there's some kind of crossover here that comes from that time that he lived first in Gath and then in Ziklag. I gave you time, Vivica. Did you come up
with that? Yes, it says we raided the Negev of the Perizzites and the territory belonging to Judah and the Negev of Caleb, and we burned
Ziklag.
Yeah, yeah. And Ziklag was where David lived. Somewhere there's this tie-in between some of those people building a loyalty to David, and this was the guy who was in charge of that particular group. And it seems to be a group fairly close. So what you have is the Secret Service. Okay, you got the people who keep the records. I think that's the second one of those described. You got somebody who puts all those records in some place where you can keep them and begins to make sense out of them in an overarching, ongoing way, like a historian would. Archivists and historians sort of work together, but it's not quite the same thing. And you've got the priests. Now, there's only one thing left. What's left?
David's sons.
And what were they?
Chief ministers.
Okay. I want to hear. Yours says chief ministers.
Royal advisors. Priests, and yet from
yours
the Chronicles.
Yours says the Chronicles, right?
It says advisors.
Yeah, when you go to the parallel of Chronicles, it says advisors. Right. This is one of the places where it's not amended, it's emended. The chronicler has emended this to say a little bit more clearly so you understand. What it looks like, there's footnotes and commentators who comment about this. There were things that the kings did in partnership with the priests in leading worship and leading other things. The priests had the role that they were given by Exodus and Leviticus, but the kings also had a responsibility to work with them, and David's son seems to have done that. But more than that, they seem to have been advisors and other sorts of folks like that. So far, okay? Now, that's chapter 8, but I want to take just a moment before I go any further, first to answer or to respond to, because I don't answer very much very well, to respond to Judy's question. Then I got one more thing I want to ask you. Yes, Judy.
A little out of context, but these annals of the kings that they refer to, both in Kings and Chronicles, do they exist in today's world? Have we ever seen them?
Not that I know.
They've been lost.
But I don't know that anyone has those.
That would be interesting.
It would be.
Okay. Now my question to you is, who were David's sons? Now to answer that question, where do you go? The answer in the first hour was Google. I want a better answer out of you. Google is not the answer I want. Where do you go to find out who David's sons were? The answer is you back up a little bit, because they're listed earlier in this book, or you go later in this book. They're actually up there, a couple other places, and there's a place or two in First Chronicles. And if you go back, what you find is he had sons born to him in Hebron while he was king of, Linda, this is for you, king of Judah, but not yet king of Israel, right? And then when he got to Jerusalem, he had more sons. And there's two lists so far. And then it says after this, and he had sons and daughters with some of the concubines who were there, and there's tender ears, so we'll go no further down that road. But who were those? What was special about the first six, the ones born in Hebron? Remember what was special about those? Remember what was special about those? Six children, six mothers. Six children, six mothers. Now, I told you back then, so which of those was first born? As was all of them. All of them. First born to that mother. You got problems down this road. And I simply want to point out to you, if you keep an eye on who David's sons are, there's time. You got time to do this. You can go back. You can find out who the firstborn was, who the secondborn was, who the thirdborn was, fourth one, in order, anyway, because the Bible tells you that. Although each one of them could have thought, well, I'm the firstborn for my mama. And where was Solomon in this group? Was he in the first six, or was he in the 11 or 12 or 13 that were born in Jerusalem? 11 or 13. Is he the first one listed among the ones listed for Jerusalem? But if you go to Chronicles, which most of you haven't done yet, what you find is the first four listed, of which Solomon is the fourth, those are all children from Bathsheba, and her story is coming, but it won't come today. David with Bathsheba, four sons are listed. And Solomon is the fourth of those. And he was either the first, that child died, we'll learn that later, or the second. Solomon was the next one born to David and Bathsheba, and yet he's listed fourth. So the order isn't order of birth. And that's the first wife he has who has more than one son. There may have been some others in the aftergroup. But it's really important to sort of get an idea of who those are, because it may be useful to you to to have that. Okay, I have my list written out, so I'm ready to refer to that. Okay, now, chapter 7, what happened? David had rest from the enemies around him, and that means he had time to think, and he starts to think, and he says, there's something I should be doing for the Ark of the Covenant, which represents God's actual presence among us. There's something I should be doing for them. Chapter 9 isn't echoed in Chronicles. It's only here. But what's he thinking about here? Look at the first verse. What's in his mind now? David asks, is there anyone belonging to Saul's family left to whom I might show faithful love for Jonathan's sake? He mentions Saul's family, but he focuses on Jonathan. If you remember, Saul was trying to kill him and almost succeeded on a number of occasions. Jonathan was David's closest friend. But he's not doing something for Jonathan's family. He's doing something for Saul's family for Jonathan's sake. I'm inviting you, again, I've done this before, to try to keep an eye on times when David does something that is completely puzzling to all the people around him. This would be one of those times. Now, if a king said this, what would be the sort of common response? Let's make sure we got them all. Which means if you hear that he's asking about Saul's family and you're one, what does that engender in you? Terror, I think, would be the softest of the words that you might look for. So far, okay? You just might be scared. Verse 2. Saul's family had a servant whose name was, now we've already had Zoba, so we're going to call this guy Ziba. Is that okay? Zoba's the place, Ziba's the guy. When he had been summoned to David, the king said, are you Ziba? And the guy replied, and I love this, at your service. Okay. The king said, is there no one left belonging to Saul's family for me to treat with God's own faithful love? That's the second time that's been used. How's that phrase, faithful love, recorded in your translation? What does it say?
Kindness.
Kindness is what yours says. Anything else?
It says it's a hesed.
You bet. That's probably the big word of the Old Testament. The corresponding word of the New Testament is agape. The highest kind of love you can have. Hesed is the Hebrew, it's not the Hebrew word for, but it's the Hebrew concept that most closely parallels the concept that emerges out of the word agape. Ziba said to the king, there is still one of Jonathan's sons, and then he adds a piece of information.
He's crippled
in his feet. Now why would Ziba mention that? Louder.
He's not a threat.
He's got crippled feet. How's he going to be a threat to you? You can safely leave him alone. The king asked, where is he? And Ziba says, he's living in the household of this person, who's the son of that person, and it's located at the town of Lodavar or something like that. So far, okay? So the king sent for him to be fetched from the house of so-and-so, son of so-and-so at Lodavar, and he has him brought to the palace. What do you think is the thought going through this poor guy's mind? I'm on my way to die. That's the most likely thing to happen. On entering David's presence, and now for the first time it names this fellow. Tells you a bit later in the chapter that he's old enough to have a son, and it names the son. But it names the person. What's the name given in your translation?
Yes.
Is it Mephibosheth?
Yes.
Or is it Meribaal? Anybody got Meribaal? M-E-R-R-I. Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's two B's. Two B's, A-A-L. Baal was the name of a false god who became very significant later in the kingdom period. And probably was around and known to the people now. I'm told by some of the commentators that the scribes, the ones who would record scripture faithfully, would not write the name of the false god. And therefore, in some of the copies that they had, the word Baal was replaced with gibberish, and that that's what the Mephibosheth is doing. It's replacing a word that they didn't want to even acknowledge that this false god had a name. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that depending on which source you have, and there's several copies from different sources, some in Greek, some in Latin, some in Hebrew, of these things the translators use. So that's the reason for two different names. So mine says Meribaal. We'll go with that for a moment. I hope that that's okay with you. Son of Jonathan, son of Saul, fell on his face and prostrated himself. I thought falling on his face was prostrating himself. David says, Meribaal. Mine's got an exclamation point at the end of it. George, nice to see you. Here's Meribaal quaking in fear. And what's the first thing David says?
Don't be afraid.
Meribaal, without even looking up, probably says, I'm at your service. Don't be afraid. And then what he says would have stunned Meribaal and anybody close by. I will indeed treat you with faithful love for your father Jonathan's sake. I will restore all. Do you see the word all? All of your grandfather Saul's estates to you. Estates is plural. And you will eat at my table as if you were one of my sons. Meribaal prostrated himself and said, who is your servant for you to show favor to a dead dog like me? It turns out if you look carefully, David actually said words like this to a king when he was in the power of that king briefly. This is what you say when you're terrified. The king then summoned Ziba and said to Ziba, what? Can you sort of summarize this? You've read this, right? This was your assignment.
Right.
You guys are off the hook, but everybody else. This was your assignment. Well, basically, what does he say to Ziba?
He says, I've restored Saul's estate to him, and you and your servants and your family are to serve him.
You're to run it. Where has Ziba been? What do you think? Probably in hiding. Tells you later he's got 15 sons and 20 slaves. What have they been eating? What have they been wearing? Answer, not much and not much. And all of a sudden, he's in charge of all of Saul's estates, plural, with Meribaal over with David eating at his table. In the New Testament, there's a lot of attention on stewards. This is what they're talking about. Ziba does not own a thing, but all of a sudden he's in charge of everything. If you want to put a parallel in for what stewardship talks about in the New Testament, this is an awfully good place to go and look. Keep an eye on Ziba. He's going to show up again. Keep an eye on Meribaal. He's going to show up again.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Wouldn't word of the relationship of David and Jonathan gotten to his children?
Probably, but the relationship between David and Saul would have also gotten to them. It'd be hard to know which one of those would win out. This probably won't work. This probably won't work at all. But I work with a lot of compounds in my research that are they're sensitive to air. And the result is I have an inert atmosphere box. So it's got big black gloves on it, sticky hand-suit gloves. You can work inside the box. And inside there, there's supposed to be no oxygen and no water. So you work with things, right? Okay. I have attached to that box a vacuum pump. So if the pressure inside gets too high, it'll lower the pressure. I have an automatic control sitting over here. I also have a nitrogen line bringing in fresh nitrogen. So if the pressure gets too low, it'll let nitrogen in to replace it. Okay, that box went bad one day. It had solenoids opening and closing valves to let vacuum or nitrogen get. They both opened. What's happening now? Nitrogen is flooding into the box. Doing what? Expanding everything. Vacuum is on full, pulling everything out. Okay. You know what happened? The first thing was that the gloves imploded. They pulled in. It's amazing how far the gloves can stretch. It's amazing how far the gloves can stretch. All you see is black inside the box when these gloves went in. Okay? But they hit something sharp back in there, and the gloves popped. And then it was sort of all over with. Okay? Turns out this wasn't the only time that happened. It happened another time. And the second time it happened, the nitrogen won out, and the gloves came out of the box. You can't believe how big they were. Okay, so you got two competing things. Did it work? You got two competing things, and one of them could win, one of them could win. That's the... Didn't work.
You were right.
Didn't work. I think from the way they're speaking here that there was fear. This guy was not in any prominent place. He wasn't getting his head very high. David had to hunt him down. He didn't know where he was.
So maybe he was splashing in the water, and David said, "Put your feet down." He said, "Oh, shit,
you can." Yeah, I don't think he would have asked for a thing. I think this would have shocked the retainers, the people around David at his court. Okay, that's chapter 9. Let's move to chapter 10. Chapter 7, David sits there. He's got a little bit of time to think. What's happening with God's ark isn't right. I've got to do something about that. Chapter 9, he begins to have a little bit of time to think. He thinks about Jonathan. Is there anybody left out of Saul's family? His mercy and his faithful love, his hesed, is wider than just Jonathan. And I think that is to David's credit. In chapter 10, what does he think about? You've read this, right? What does he think about? If I look, faithful love shows up in verse 2. So whatever word you had in place of faithful love, that ought to show up in yours in verse 2. Does it? After this, the king of the Ammonites, the king of Ammon, died, and his son Hanun succeeded him. And David thought, I'll show Hanun, the son of Nahash, the dead king, the same faithful love his father showed me. Now, what does that mean? Well, you have to go back, and you might have to read between the lines, because I don't know how well this is spelled out. But basically, David had been on the run for quite a while, and part of his time he was hiding in the Philistines, but that got hot, so part of his time he was someplace else. You have the picture, and I'd have to go back and look and see if I can find the specific place. I haven't done that. But the king of Ammon probably gave him sanctuary for a while at a time when it is not at all clear that David was ever become king, ever going to have power like he has now. So the faithful love that David was shown by the former king was shown without any hope of repaying. It was simply goodness and kindness that he showed to David. And David hears that the guy dies and he says, I want to honor him. He showed me faithful love at a time when he didn't have to. I want to show him faithful love. And so he sent representatives, it says, to offer condolences over his father. But the representatives got an interesting reception. Have you read this?
Yeah.
This is funny. What happens? Some of the princes around the king whispered in his ear. What did they whisper? You just think they're coming to be nice to you. They're really coming to spy you out. And they're going to attack. And they're going to take over your kingdom. You're going to be killed or put in prison or worse. And you better run these guys off. And who did the king listen to? Listen to these princes. So what did he do? Took half of their beard. Now, it does not say if the half of the beard was this way. Or if it was this way. If it was this way, that'd be mutton chops. If it was a quarter here and a quarter here, that'd be a Van Dyke that was left, right? Either one of those would have looked at least somewhat presentable. If you do it, it's probably done this way. Take off half the beard. And what else did they do? They put him in Steve Farley's Henrico Doctor's Hospital gown. Read it. Right? All the way up to here. Chip them away. Somebody in the first hour said, is this the first case of mooning in the Bible? And I said, maybe so. Maybe so. What have they done? They have done the most insulting things they can do without causing physical harm. And everybody knows it. And they sent them back to David that way. What's David's response? Very interesting. What have we looked at in previous weeks? When it comes time for David to do something, what does he sometimes do and what does he sometimes not do? He sometimes consults the Lord, he sometimes doesn't consult the Lord. What's he doing this time? He's not consulting yet. He's just mad. And verse 6, this is where we went before. It suddenly occurs to the people of Ammon that maybe they made a mistake. And so they start looking for allies, and the first people they find are people from Aram that are living in Zobah, and off we go with all the things we talked about before. Now, was this the same thing as chapter 8, or was this something new? I think it's something new, but I don't know that for sure. And there's not too much interesting in here. The people from Israel win, and they win convincingly, but there's something that's big enough to notice. Verse 9, David's not there, Joab is. These allies that the people of Ammon have managed to come up with are about to attack Joab on two fronts. If you know anything about military warfare, fighting on two fronts is tough. So what does Joab do? Verse 10. He takes part of the army and drew them up in the line facing Ammon. And who does he send with the other half of the army to face the other way? Well, we've seen this guy before. This is Abishai, right? We're keeping track of this, right? And he drew them up in the line facing the Ammonites. And the power of this part is in verse 11. What does he say? He does not entertain the thought that both of them were going to lose. He does entertain the thought that one of them might be losing. If I'm getting overrun, you come help me. If you're getting overrun, I'll come help you. That summarizes the way Christians ought to support each other. When the tough times come for me, and they will, I hope some of you will support me. When the tough times come for you, I hope you'll let me support you. That's the way it ought to work. That's the way it ought to work. Okay. If you keep going, the rest of the chapter talks about how tough it was. And verse 19, everything is finally placated. Everything is finally done. And what does that mean? That means David's got another time where, okay, there's not a whole lot of fighting I still have to do. And thus starts chapter 11. And we've got 3 minutes to start chapter 11. And we're only going to do verse 1. I believe we've looked at this on a previous week. We're going to look at it again. You cannot go past verse 1. Verse 1. Mine starts at the turn of the year. What does yours say? In the spring. When I file my taxes, the forms say, what year are you filing for? Are you filing for a calendar year from January 1 to December 31, or are you filing for some other yearly period? The place I work runs on a fiscal year that runs from July 1 to June 30 of the next year, right? When did the year start for these guys? In the springtime, because mine says at the turn of the year, and yours says at springtime, and that's the same time. I told you I'm listening to a story of Churchill through World War II, and one of the interesting things was that when winter came, everybody's army got bogged down. And so, first of all, you got to get through winter, and then you got to have all the mud dry up. And then and only then can you start to fight again. So something like that seems to be here. At the turn of the year, mine says, at the time when kings go to war or go campaigning or take to the field, right? What did David do? At the time when kings are supposed to go to war, the king didn't go to war. What did he do? He sent Joab. Where did they go? They went to finish the fight with the people of Ammon, it looks like. They had a siege going on. They were down there doing that. Where was David? Stayed in Jerusalem. I'm going to let you look at the first 15 or 20 words of verse 2, but no further. No further. It appears that David was taking afternoon naps, and after his nap, he went to get some exercise by taking a walk. Where did he walk? On the roof of the palace, and what he saw kicks off the next part. And that's all you get for today. Okay? Let's have a word of prayer as we go. I'm sorry, did you have something, Paul? I thought I saw you. Okay. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, today we're coming off of a high spot, as you explained one of your covenants to David. We're now back to where there's lots of fighting going on. But in this, we've seen two glimpses. One is that you have a faithful servant in David who, when his mind is given a chance to think, begins to think of doing good for somebody else, starting with doing something good for the signal of your presence among them, the ark, and then doing something good, not just for Jonathan, but for Saul's whole family. And then thinking of doing something good to people who had treated him well at a time when they didn't have to, and at a time when there was no reward for doing so. we begin to realize that David is seeing things in a way that isn't quite like everybody else sees them, and most of the time, we're sorry to say, as we sometimes miss things. Help us begin to have David's eye, and also to have the time to really think through what's going on in our lives around us. Give us a chance to think about those who have been kind to us when there's no reward in it for them, and to be able to say thank you. And have us, even for some people who had been our enemies, to find ways to show them the kind of faithful love that you show us. And we also notice with Joab's words to Abishai that sometimes one of us has a battle that's about to overrun them, that maybe we ought to help, because the day may come that their help will help us get through a similar time. We thank you for these insights into who you are and how you function. And I pray that you would bring us back next week refreshed and ready to look again. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.